From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, from punk rock to spoken word, we talk with Henry Rollins. His stage monologues have been compared to Lenny Bruce's because of their dark, honest humor. Also on this Academy Award Day, we talk with one of America's leading film critics, Terrence Rafferty. He writes for The New Yorker. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Rape of the Rose, a new historical novel by Glyn Hughes about Britain's Luddite Rebellion. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate Armed Services Committee opened hearings today on the issue of homosexuals in the military, and Chairman Sam Nunn offered a compromise. The Georgia Democrat proposed that the administration should simply adopt President Clinton's interim policy of not asking recruits about their sexual orientation. Nunn and other key members of the committee have opposed the president's proposal to do away with the ban on homosexuals entirely. Today's committee session was devoted to expert testimony on the legal and constitutional issues surrounding the dispute. There was a twist today in the Los Angeles trial of the four police officers accused of violating Rodney King's civil rights. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports that a defense witness offered testimony that could help the prosecution.
For the second day, California Highway Patrol officer Melanie Singer wept on the stand as she described the beating of Rodney King. She told the jury she saw defendant Lawrence Powell strike King in the face with the baton. "I will never forget it till the day I die," she said, beginning to weep. Officer Singer was the officer who pulled King over after the high-speed chase. The lawyer for Officer Lawrence Powell first called her to the stand on Friday to talk about the car chase and King's behavior. She provided that information, helpful to the defense, but then stunned everyone with emotional testimony about how Officer Powell had struck King in the head. She also refuted defense contentions that King appeared to be on PCP. She said he was not sweating profusely and was not talking gibberish. Finally, Singer told how officers stood around joking after the beating. She said she wanted to give aid to the injured King, but decided against it because she feared the other officers would heckle her. At the federal courthouse in Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
Several published reports raised questions today about a letter claiming responsibility for the World Trade Center bombing. The letter said the bomb was planted to protest U.S. policy in the Middle East. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
The letter was sent to the New York Times 4 days after the bombing and signed by a group calling itself the Liberation Army 5th Battalion. It warned of further attacks against U.S. targets if Washington didn't cut off relations with Israel and stop interfering in the affairs of Middle East countries. Sources close to the investigation today corroborated reports that the letter was signed by one of the men arrested in the Trade Center bombing. But several newspapers quoted unnamed federal officials today as saying that no definitive link has been established. Meanwhile, a report issued today said the explosion will cost insurance companies more than $500 million. Most of the money will go for repairs and to compensate tenants for lost business and extra expenses incurred by the closing of the complex. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
The Dow Industrials gained more than 15 points today. This is NPR News. French President François Mitterrand has appointed a conservative to serve as prime minister and to form a new government following the defeat of the socialists in yesterday's general election. Mitterrand has named Edouard Balladur, a 63-year-old Gaullist, to replace socialist prime minister Pierre Bergoglio. In its first public meeting, the White House Task Force on Health Care Reform brought together representatives from 63 different special interest groups. Each group has its own agenda for reform. NPR's Patricia Naimond reports.
The meeting started with calls for long-term care from a variety of senior citizen advocates who want any reform plan to cover care in the home and include some financial aid for families caring for loved ones. Small business leaders said the administration proposal to require all employers to provide health benefits is un-American and could cause some companies to lay off workers, cut wages, or even go out of business. Groups representing minority consumers, including American Indians and Hispanics, called for a Canadian-like government-run system. Vice President Al Gore, who is chairing this meeting while Task Force Chief Hillary Rodham Clinton remains with her sick father in Little Rock, said the administration supports the streamlined bureaucracy of a Canadian system. But he said he remains committed to the uniquely American idea of managed competition. In Washington, I'm Patricia Naiman reporting.
The ceasefire in Bosnia appears to be holding. The lull in the fighting allowed the United Nations to evacuate more than 2,000 Muslim refugees from the besieged eastern city of Srebrenica. The refugees were taken from the city by truck, and reports said that at least some died on the way. Witnesses said they were held for as much as 5 hours at the last Serbian checkpoint as Bosnian Serbs searched for weapons and men of military age. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the more recent and increasingly popular forms of theater is the autobiographical monologue. My guest Henry Rollins may strike you as an unlikely candidate for this kind of performance because he comes from the world of punk rock, where vocals usually had more to do with aggressive attitude than narrative development. But believe me, he's awfully good at his talking performances. Rollins first became known as the vocalist with Black Flag. Reviewing his spoken word show for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Roberto Santiago wrote, "What makes Rollins a remarkable performance artist is his ability to instantly bring insight and humor into tragic events without coming off as a preachy educator or a rehearsed nightclub comic." Rollins' talk performances have been released by Imago Records. I asked him about the difference between performing with his band and standing on stage alone telling stories.
Well, with the music, it's usually a very humorless, very violent, explosive affair. And with the spoken word, it tends to lend itself more towards smiling and laughing and enjoyment like that.
So it brings out different parts of your personality?
Yeah, well, you know, you lock a mere mortal in a room with a band on 11 and a bunch of people sweating and, you know, what's he supposed to do? Sit there and act like he's, you know, going to the dentist or something? I mean, there's different levels of excitement, and I don't go out and do talking shows and stand there and jump up and down and scream. So, you know, the talking shows tend to be a bit more low-key in some ways, like overall volume.
Mm-hmm.
But the intensity is pretty much the same level both times.
You're the kind of person who would definitely stand out in a crowd, just visually even. You have enormous muscles from bodybuilding, a really kind of developed neck from bodybuilding. You have tattoos down your arm and the back of your neck and on your back. So I guess you'd have to be wearing at least a short-sleeve shirt to see some of this. Do strange things happen to you when you're in a group of people because of the way that you stand out?
Oh, well, yeah, people have been staring at me, looking at me funny since I was about 20 years old. So it's all right.
So how did you start bodybuilding?
Well, I don't do that. I just lift a lot of weights. There's a lot of, it's kind of a different approach. I lift for fitness and strength and, you know, because I like life. But I've been working out since I was about 14 on and off. But the last 4 or 5 years, mainly on, and more, in the last 5 years, it gets more and more to where now I go in about 6 days a week.
What are the tattoos you have on your arms?
All kinds of things. I mean, I know we're talking to people out there in radio land, but I don't know. There's lots of stuff. You know, it's not something I sit down and talk about. You know, some people... feel the need to get tattoos. Obviously, in my case, it comes from some kind of insecurity where just being born wasn't good enough. I had to customize myself in a certain way. I guess perhaps as to not sort of not look like my mother and father or anyone else. And obviously working off an insecurity, as do most people who take the stage.
So have you often been kind of like singled out by either police or by punks because of the way you look?
I've been singled out by police in major cities all over the world at different times, which is too bad because I'm not a criminal type. You know, I don't do that which is illegal. You know, I don't hurt people or mug people or break into their homes or anything. So to walk the streets of Los Angeles and have a cop pull you over, you know, as you're walking and call you a bunch of names and threaten you is kind of hard to take.
Let me read a catchy quote of yours. I was raised to hurt myself and hate myself. Would you explain that?
It's interesting that you said it's catchy.
Well,
if I would have fully realized the vision my parents had set out for me, I would have turned into just a self-effacing and eventually self-erasing person, you know, who would cower and shake. I mean, spending time with my father was basically walking tiptoe on rice paper through a minefield. The mission was get through the weekend and don't get backhanded. You know, don't get smacked in public. Don't get whacked. That was how I used to deal with my dad. It was never about conversation or learning anything. It was just don't do the wrong thing and get belted. And so that kind of makes you kind of a fidgety, nervous person when you're young, and you get very prone to explosive violence and a lot of paranoia. And on my mother's side, there's just a lot of fear there, you know, a lot of fear with her boyfriends and just her tension that and her thing that she was going through. And, you know, to have all that and then go to an all-boys school at the same time and not be able to relate to women, although you wanted to. By the time I was 18, I was an extremely tense young man.
You went to a military school, didn't you?
Yeah, it's a naval preparatory school. They got people ready for the Naval Academy and West Point. And so all my teachers were ex-military, and there's a real emphasis on athletics and really hard education. And the teachers were allowed to whack the students, and I was on a lot of drugs at the time, not by my own will. It was Ritalin. You know, for hyperactivity.
Oh, I thought they just gave that to kids.
Yeah, they gave it to me till I was about in about 10th grade, and then I stopped taking it. I was on it from kindergarten up.
Let me get back to the military academy. How did you react to the strict discipline of military training?
Okay, well, it wasn't like we fell out with rifles every morning at 6 a.m., but, you know, it was a dress code that was adhered to, and there was detention. And, you know, you were told to, you know, stand up straight and all that. And it had a good effect on me. I mean, this discipline's a good thing to have. It gets you, you know, up in the morning and gets you where you need to go. My father instilled in me a lot of discipline, and I definitely think it's a virtue. If you notice, anyone who is successful or has traits that you admire, they're usually very disciplined.
How did you use that discipline on yourself? What did you discipline yourself to do?
Well, I always worked after school. You know, I always had money in my pocket because I always had a job. I was working since I was in fourth grade. And I'd work all through the weekend. And anything I was really interested in, I would go at with all speed. You know, I'd study. There's things I was actually interested in besides, you know, running around and, you know, riding a bike into a tree like most young kids. I read books. I read authors. I read about them. I learned about certain animal groups. I went to a pet shop and got a job there just so I could learn about snakes, you know. I had interest.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Henry Rollins, and he's a leader of the Henry Rollins Band and also does a lot of talking performances and has a series of audio cassettes and CDs called The Box Life, and has a video of one of his performances called Talking from the Box. Let's see. When you dropped out of college early on, right?
Yeah, I started in 1979, I guess. And I just found it all very, very boring, you know. I was using my ninth grade math book. My fellow students in the English class were really stupid. And I said, I don't want to do this for 4 years.
So when you left college, what did you do with yourself?
I went out and got a job.
What kind of job?
I worked at an ice cream store. Went in because all my friends worked there, so I got a job there. And after the first day of work, I went to the boss and I said, "Well, you know, you should make me a manager of your store, a shift manager, because I can save you some money here." And I showed him a few different things, and he said, "All right, wise guy, you work here 2 more weeks, and if you don't screw up, we'll make you a manager. If you screw up once, you're out of here." I said, "That's a good deal." I think he liked me, you know. And so he made me a manager. Then I became the head manager, and then I pretty much started running the whole place, hiring, firing, inventory, deposits, had the keys to the whole place. I'd be there about 60 hours a week, and then I joined Black Flag and started this life of somewhat dubious celebrity.
Would you tell a story of how you joined the band?
Sure. I was always a fan of the band, and I lived in Washington, D.C., and they lived in Los Angeles. And they would come out to Washington, D.C., where I was living, and they would play, and they would sleep at my friend's house because they were these guys living in a van, and we'd all put them up and feed them and hang out. And they were very nice people, and I really liked the band. It really, they were saying what I wanted to say. You know, they had that rage that I was feeling. And I went to go up to go see them in New York of March of 81 because they were not playing in Washington. So I drove up to New York to see them, took a day off from my job. And they did an after-show party at this small club in the Village. So I went there with them, and they were playing away in this bar just for, like, you know, 50 people who just kind of heard the word and went down there. And I told the guys, I said, "Hey, you know, play the song Clocked In," which is a song about going to work, because I had to leave right from that club and drive down to D.C. and go to work. And I hadn't slept yet, so it was going to be a hard shift. So they said, "All right, let's do Clocked In for Henry." And, you know, they started playing, and I kind of looked at the singer, Dez, and kind of looked at the microphone, and he said, "Here, take it." You know, just gave me the mic, and I just sang the song, because I knew it. And everyone in the band was kind of looking at me going, "Wow, that was wild." And everyone in the crowd was kind of nodding their heads like, "That sure was cool." And then I just didn't think anything more of it than, "Wow, I can tell my friends at home I did a song with Black Flag, man. That's pretty bitchin'." So I went, got in my car, went back down to Washington and worked. And later on that week, the guys in the band called me from New York and said, "Well, you know, we're auditioning new singers because our singer Dez wants to move down to rhythm guitar. And we really liked what you did the other night. Would you like to come up here and try it out?" I went, "Yeah." So I took a train up there and, you know, sang 2 sets with them. What I knew I sang, what I didn't know I improvised, and I got in the band.
Why don't I play something from your one of your records with Black Flag?
All right.
Gallant, coward, ride the cold. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Make this score what we say. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Try and stop what we do. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. When they can't do it themselves. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Way up higher, up yours.
That's Black Flag with my guest Henry Rollins doing the vocals. When you were first performing with Black Flag, what were some of the things that the audience would do as you were performing?
Well, you know, every physical move you could think as far as arms and legs moving around. Sometimes they would get a bit antagonistic. They would hurl objects at the singer's head, put themselves on stage and swing at my face, try and light certain parts of my anatomy on fire with Bic lighters. It was always an interesting adventure at every Black Flag show. You know, music was only part of it. It was...
Did you find yourself both liking and really detesting some of your fans?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that was the hard part about Black Flag. Some of the people at our shows, I wouldn't ever want to see again. I don't want to know them. You know, guys coming up and Sieg Heiling, you know, skinheads. Mm-hmm. I'm not into that kind of stuff.
Henry Rollins is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You're just joining us. My guest is Henry Rollins. He's a writer, vocalist, leads the Rollins Band, and now he has several cassettes, CDs called The Box Life of some of his talking performances. There's also a video of one of his talking performances. Let me ask you about something that happened last year, something really awful. Your very close friend of many years was killed, Joe Cole. You were with him. You had just rented a movie, and you were coming home to the house that you shared to watch it when you were held up. Would you tell us what happened?
Yeah, well, me and my pal Joe was coming home from the store, and these two guys came out of the bushes with guns, and they put them in our faces. They said, "This is a hold up," and they held us up, and they said, we're gonna go into your house now." So I knew they were going to take us in and kill us. I mean, you know, just I could just see us having to go into the back room and, you know, put our heads on the floor and just get shot. So I just kind of, I don't know, I wasn't all that afraid. Not that I was all brave and was going to wrestle a gun away from someone. It was just, like, so factual that you just kind of went, oh, well, this is how it ends up, I guess, you know. I was terrified, but at the same time, you're just like, well, this is all happening so fast, you know. But the guy put the gun in my back, and I had the key, so I kind of led the way, and I had the three of them behind me, Joe and two gunmen. I opened the door, walked into the living room of the house, and put my groceries down and stuck my hands in the air and awaited further instruction. And I heard gunshots behind me. And the gunshot stopped, and I ran out the back of the house and ran up the alley and called the cops. And what had happened was the guy had shot Joe. Someone did. I mean, I my back turns. I don't know exactly the sequence of events, but from where I was standing and tracing where the bullets went, the guy shot at me twice and missed me by about, I'd missed my upper back by about 2 inches on my left side and probably about the same on the other side. I think he shot me left to right because the second one went a little wider, which means he was probably on the fly as he was doing it. But Joe was killed on the front lawn, and the cops came and arrested me and took me down to the police station.
You know, you called the cops when you escaped. How did they end up arresting you?
Well, because they got a call about a suspect in dark clothing, a male, and that was me. And so they arrested me, and they...
Was that your call that said dark clothing, or was that somebody else who called?
No, that was me.
So you described someone in dark clothing. They assumed it was you when they found you.
Uh-huh. I just kind of wandered into the middle of the street in shock, and I saw that our local plainclothes car, because I lived in a crack neighborhood, so you get to recognize all the plainclothes cars, and I saw this guy coming the wrong way up the street, so I started flagging him down, so I recognized his car. And he said, you know, the bullhorn came on and said, "Go to the side of the, you know, curb, put your hands on your head." I said, no, I'm the one who called you, you know, and I started shouting out my street address. And then they got mad, you know, they go to the side of the curb, and they came out and they had their guns out and they arrested me. I'm going, "No, I'll take you to the place, come on, I'll," you know, and they're like, "Just get in the car and shut up." So.
So how was that resolved?
It wasn't. It was...
I mean, how did they release you?
Well, they released me 10 hours later. They kept me there overnight because I was the only witness, and I had to wait for the detectives to get back from the scene so I could give my report. You know, they could ask me, and I could, you know, give them a verbal statement of what I saw and what happened.
Were you still a suspect then?
Not really. It was never formally said, "We think you did it." I mean, no one ever said, "You killed Joe." But what the drag was is these detectives, they need a motive. They don't understand what the reason was why this happened. So they're going, "Okay, you guys must have been drug dealers." And, you know, the hardest core thing we ever did at that house was, like, I think spinach noodles, you know? I mean, we're so lightweight. We were into working out and you know, eating pasta. And, you know, Joe didn't even drink coffee, you know? So that was totally out of the question. But these guys would grill me for months about how Joe and I were coke dealers. It's like, "Fellas, you know, we're not coke dealers. It's just not an option there." Took them a while to get off that track.
Did you ever try to find the killers?
Me?
Well, I mean...
Get on the public bus and go drive around Venice? Does anyone know anyone who killed anyone around here? No,
No, but you know what I mean? You can really kind of apply heat to the investigators to
Well, I know the two detectives who are on the case, and there's not a whole lot I can tell them about their job.
Yeah.
And I don't think... these guys are really good, and they're really cool people. I don't mind these two detectives, even though they are cops. You know, and I don't think any cop can be trusted. But these guys are definitely into nailing this guy. They're still on it. And so I can't, I mean, I give them every, you know, whenever they say, hey, can you call us in, you know, I guess they're not used to having witnesses be all that cooperative. They said I'm the most cooperative witness they've ever had. Because I give them my tour schedule, I give them all my phone numbers. I go, you know, tell me the day you need me, I'll call you. You know, or if I'm in L.A., I'm going to be in L.A. from here to here. When you need me, call me. I'll go down, look at pictures, you know. They want me to take a polygraph test, and I got nothing to hide. So I said, anytime, anywhere.
You don't still live in a crack neighborhood, do you?
Yeah, I do, because I live in L.A., and L.A. has turned into one big crack neighborhood, unfortunately. I'm not trying to be all dramatic, but I live in Hollywood now, and Hollywood used to be just kind of dirty, you know, where you just didn't want to get any on you. But now my neighborhood, Central Hollywood, has turned into definitely a crack neighborhood. All these Crips have come up from South Central because there's no gangs in Hollywood, and so there's no one really running the streets as far as drug trade. So these guys have a wide open market. So now I got guys on my corner everywhere I go. And they're scary too. Really scary guys.
So you must still feel pretty vulnerable in your neighborhood.
Yeah, I feel vulnerable everywhere I go due to the recognition factor, which is kind of unnerving. But in that neighborhood, I don't like going out of my own place after 2 a.m.
Well, do you think that you're more protected or less protected when you're recognized?
Well, when you get recognized by someone, they always have the jump on you. They know who you are. I don't know who they are. You know, I don't know what they want to do. You know, I don't know when some guy's going to go, hey, you, and they'll hand me a pen and a piece of paper, or they'll be sticking a gun in my face. I don't know. You know, and it's not always pleasant just walking down the street trying to, you know, think about something and just have... All of a sudden, some guy has his arm around you. He's run up from behind you and have your heart leap up into your throat. And it's like this guy is running, put up his arm around you and going, God, I can't believe it's you. You're like, hey, you know, you shouldn't come up on someone's back like that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, take care, and thank you very, very much for doing the interview.
Okay, see ya.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Henry Rollins. His spoken word performances are featured on the CD The Boxed Life, which is distributed by Imago Records. This week, Henry Rollins will perform in Santa Barbara, New Orleans, and Houston. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Like, I've been to England 15 times. 15 times! I never liked it once. Every time I go, no, not again, not again! God! I mean, you go there and, like, everyone is so sad. I mean, they're nice people. We meet a lot of people at the shows, and everyone's really wonderful and everything, but you see why Morrissey happens. Only there. It wouldn't have happened here. Whenever I, you know, hear it, it'd be like, oh, come on, cheer up. Have some vitamin C. Here's a gun. Get out there.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, film critic Terrence Rafferty discusses his favorite Oscar-nominated and unnominated movies from the past year. Rafferty is film critic for The New Yorker. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Rape of the Rose, a new historical novel about a rebellion by British textile workers in the early 1800s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Moscow, the Russian Congress of People's Deputies has ended its current session, having decided to hold a nationwide referendum on confidence in Boris Yeltsin's presidency. But the meeting also wrapped up with little prospect that the confrontation between Yeltsin and the Congress will ease. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The rhetoric at the end of this Congress was, if anything, more heated than ever. Yeltsin's spokesman called the Congress a vindictive communist inquisition. Parliament Speaker Ruslan Hasbulatov said the Congress had stopped Yeltsin from mounting a coup d'etat. After weeks of resisting Yeltsin's calls for a nationwide vote of confidence in his presidency, the Congress finally succumbed and announced its own referendum, a vote of confidence in Yeltsin and his economic reforms, and on the question of possible early parliamentary and presidential elections. Yeltsin has not agreed to the terms of the Congress's referendum, and there exists the real possibility that on April 25th there will be two referenda in Russia, and the likelihood of further confusion and confrontation after that. In its final act, the Congress in effect censured Yeltsin by calling his speech to a crowd of supporters yesterday anti-constitutional and demanding measures to prevent Yeltsin from making similar remarks in public. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
President Clinton says that he knows that he will have to launch a public relations drive to convince Americans to support a large aid package for Russia. Speaking today with reporters in Little Rock, Mr. Clinton said that he plans to present his aid proposals next weekend in Vancouver, where he will hold his first summit meeting with Russian President Boris Yeltsin. Mr. Clinton has been in Little Rock to see his father-in-law, who is hospitalized after suffering a stroke. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Armed Services Committee has held its first hearing on homosexuals in the military. The panel heard today from legal experts and a sociologist. NPR's John Greenberg has more on the story.
The purpose of today's hearing was to put the ban against homosexuals in the armed forces into an historical and legal context. Senators heard that the ban emerged gradually during this century. Some of the key architects of the current policy around World War II were psychiatrists who believed that homosexuality was a mental disorder. Legal experts told lawmakers that the courts have upheld the military's right to exclude gays and lesbians, but they cautioned that with Clinton appointees in the federal judiciary and on the Supreme Court, that position could change. Most senators made it clear that they are suspicious of any change in the policy of excluding gays. Still, some suggested they might be interested in a compromise. President Clinton has said he will rescind the ban, but is interested in the views of Congress. This is John Greenberg on Capitol Hill.
The government says that sales of new homes moved up by 4.6% last month. At the same time, prices of new homes increased by 7.4%. The government says that there were double-digit increases in home sales in both the Northeast and the West. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 15 points. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, more than 2,000 Muslims left a besieged part of eastern Bosnia in order to flee to the north. According to reports, UN trucks were so full that refugees had to stand on their luggage, and some people fell from the convoy during their 45-mile trip. The journey was made during a ceasefire that went into effect at noon Sunday, with no major violations reported. Serbian factions had agreed to allow a convoy of food and medicine into the region. Sarajevo was also reported quiet today, as residents used the ceasefire to get outside after 3 days of snow. In Waco, Texas, the FBI spoke today with Branch Davidian cult leader David Koresh. It was the agent's first direct contact in several days. The FBI also received a videotape from inside the compound, which shows 16 of the children inside in reasonably good health. Wade Goodwin reports.
FBI spokesman Richard Swenson described the two-hour conversation with David Koresh as positive, but then went on to say that no real breakthroughs had resulted. FBI negotiators have been speaking with dozens of cult members on the phone, trying to see if anyone wants to come out, but so far, no one does. Swenson said today that they'd received a videotape which shows 16 of the 17 children inside to be in good condition. Another child is believed to be inside but was not shown on the video, and the FBI had no information about the child. Authorities delivered milk, cheese, and crackers for the children. FBI agent Swenson also confirmed that at least one of the women inside the compound is, to use his words, very pregnant, but said that he didn't know about any of the other women. There seems to be little progress toward a resolution, but today the federal authorities relented in their recent personal attacks on Koresh. For National Public Radio, I'm Wade Goodwin in Waco.
In Somalia, after a four-day show of force, some 1,300 U.S. Marines are pulling out of Kismayu. The exercise was aimed at keeping rival factions out of the city. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Most film critics have to write about the Academy Awards, like it or not, but Terrence Rafferty is film critic for The New Yorker, which gives him the liberty to ignore the awards and all the industry glitz and self-congratulations of Oscar night. So, wouldn't you know it, we call him and ask him to talk about the Oscars. Rafferty has a new collection of his film reviews and essays drawn from The New Yorker, The Nation, Sight and Sound, The Atlantic, and Film Quarterly. His book is called The Thing Happens. Well, Rafferty doesn't get to vote for the Oscars, but if he did, what would he choose as best movie of the year?
I'd vote for The Crying Game, though, with Unforgiven, a very close second.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think they're both, you know, they're both really, really stunning pictures. And they were, in fact, my favorite movies of the year. And, you know, and that's a rarity as far as the Oscars go. I mean, my two favorite movies of the year are rarely in the same... You know, the Academy's two favorite movies of the year.
Were there any smaller movies that you particularly liked that you wish had gotten a nomination?
Well, you know, most of the other movies I liked this year. Well, of course, there was The Player, which you know, which I think should have had a nomination, though I'm not entirely surprised that it didn't. Most of the other things I liked in the course of the year were not even smaller films, but documentaries, and I do think that documentaries are among the few areas of American filmmaking that are actually pretty healthy right now.
So you picked The Crying Game as a best picture of the year, mm-hmm. and Unforgiven as a kind of close number two. Mm-hmm. Would the same hold true for directors Neil Jordan and then Clint Eastwood?
Yeah, though actually, I mean, I felt about Unforgiven that I mean, I'm a long time non-fan of Clint Eastwood, and I was very pleasantly surprised by this one. I think I think this is the best job of direction he's ever done. You know, I don't put him in the same category as Neil Jordan or Robert Altman, who did, you know, a spectacular job of directing The Player. I mean, I think what's really stunning about Unforgiven is the script, which is a beautifully designed and, you know, intelligent and mordant piece of work. And, you know, Eastwood serves it beautifully, but, I mean, he's not, in a sense, the creator of that movie as, you know, as spectacularly as Neil Jordan and Altman are the creators of theirs.
Category in the Academy Awards that has been most disappointing and most depressing is the Best Actress category, because I think everybody agrees that the choices show how little there was to choose from, how few really good roles for actresses there were this year.
I actually don't agree with that.
You like these choices? Let me go through them. It's Catherine Deneuve in Indochine, Emma Thompson in Howard's End, Mary McDonnell in Passion Fish, Michelle Pfeiffer in Love Field, and Susan Sarandon in Lorenzo's Oil. You're happy with that list?
I think there are three terrific performances in there: Sarandon, Pfeiffer, and Emma Thompson, and that's, I think, about as good as we get in most years. You know, I mean, to tell you the truth, my favorite in this category is Sarandon, who I think has been doing wonderful work for the last several years, and has really reached a kind of peak in Lorenzo's Oil, a dramatic peak. I mean, her comic peak certainly was Bull Durham, but that's an astounding performance, and Michelle Pfeiffer is only, I think, slightly less good in Love Field, as she was in Batman Returns as well. I mean, she's had a terrific year. And Emma Thompson was awfully good in Howard's End. Gee, three good ones. That sounds all right to me.
Go over quickly for us who you'd vote for Best Actor.
For Best Actor? Well, you know, I mean, in this, I'm in the majority. I think Pacino was extraordinary in Scent of a Woman, which is not an extraordinary picture. But, you know, I just thought it was a remarkable performance. And, you know, from a guy who's been giving remarkable performances for, you know, with a certain hiatus in the early 80s. But, you know, he's had a terrific career, and he's done wonderful work. And, you know, I would love to see him win. You know, Robert Downey Jr. was also awfully good in, you know, in a much worse picture, Chaplin. And God, who else is nominated? Eastwood is probably that's probably the best performance he's given. Though, you know, as an actor, he's not in a class with the others.
And we have Stephen Ray.
And Stephen Ray was very good in a tough role, a very tough role in The Crying Game.
Don't you think it's time to have a best offbeat actor type award and give it to Harvey Keitel?
I don't know.
That's crazy actor.
I mean, I think there's certainly something to be said for offbeat acting. I know. I guess 5 years ago, you would have awarded it to Harry Dean Stanton, mm-hmm. or M. Emmett Walsh. You know, I mean, there is a sort of category of gonzo character actor. You know, but that's, you know, I mean, that can become a convention too, and I sometimes fear with Keitel that he's going to, you know, sort of, you know, settle into this wild man mode and, you know, and just turn into, you know, the Hunter Thompson of film acting.
Right. My guest is Terrence Rafferty. He is film critic for The New Yorker magazine and author of a new anthology called The Thing Happens. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Terrence Rafferty, film critic for The New Yorker, and he has a new anthology of his writing called The Thing Happens. I think if we were voting for Scandal of the Year, which wasn't on the list, that the Scandal of the Year would be, of course, Woody Allen and Mia Farrow.
Yep, hands down.
I want to quote something that you wrote in your review of Husbands and Wives, which is Woody Allen's latest film. And Judy Davis is nominated as Best Supporting Actress from that film. You write, the style and substance of this movie have a curdled quality, the air of things that have gone bad but haven't been thrown away. Mm-hmm. He's turned his disappointment in himself into disgust for other people. He's going down, and he's determined to take the rest of us with him. Mm-hmm. Now, I like the movie a lot better than you did, but I love that paragraph.
Well, thanks.
I think it's really, really well written. Are you very interested in watching how the man and his movies are changing and in making connections between the two?
Well, I think I've always resisted making that kind of connection because I think it's presumptuous for mm-hmm. a critic to do that. You know, in Husbands and Wives, that was probably a tougher film to write about for me than The Crying Game or virtually anything else I had to write about in the last year, just because I don't want to get into the biographical stuff. I don't want to fall into the trap of, you know, interpreting the movie through what I know about him personally. You know, you can't filter that out entirely. You know, the one thing that made it easier to write about in Husbands and Wives is that it does present itself as being something, you know, really naked and personal and, you know, straight from his psyche to the screen. I mean, I think it's to a certain extent oppose, but it makes you feel a little less bad about talking about him in that sort of personal way. I mean, and I do believe that even had I known nothing about his personal problems and about the scandal, that I would have written about the movie in the same way. I mean, I think it I mean, that's what comes off the screen is that sort of, I don't know, it's a sort of cynical pose. I mean, a sense of you know, weariness with all the, you know, the problems and difficulties of relationships that, I don't know, it's just one of those movies that just, you know, stunned me with its bad faith.
I guess where you saw it as the cynical pose, I saw it as the genuine article, genuine weariness.
Yeah, but, you know, but he's always, I mean, genuine weariness is one thing. I mean, I can appreciate that. but he's also, I feel like he's stacking it to a certain extent. I mean, he is still making himself, the character who is, you know, who is indissolubly himself and a stand-in for his own personal feelings. I mean, he is elevating that character at the expense of the people who have somehow disappointed him. I mean, he comes off as the world weary, sort of the man without illusions at the end, and that strikes me as being evasive and cynical in the wrong way.
What are the movies that made you, the movies that you fell in love with when you were young and very impressionable?
When I was young and very impressionable, my heroes, my movie-making heroes were John Huston, Humphrey Bogart, and the Marx Brothers. These were the movies that I watched on television when I was at the impressionable age of, say, 12 or something like that. And, I watch these things again, and, you know, they still delight me. The Maltese Falcon, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, Duck Soup. These are my standards. And, as I went through adolescence and in college, I'd say that the most influential new movies that I came across were Bonnie and Clyde in 1967 and The Wild Bunch in 1969 and McCabe and Mrs. Miller in 1971. And these were the pictures that just blew me away when my ideas about movies were being formed. And also in college, I mean, I was seeing, you know, the best of the past, Jules and Jim, The Rules of the Game. These were movies that had, you know, a profound impact on me when I was, in my formative years.
I'd like to talk with you a little bit about the process of reviewing. When you review a movie, do you usually end up going to a screening that's held for other film critics and people in the industry?
Ordinarily, that's what I do, yeah.
Are you taking notes while the movie's on?
Yep, I sure am.
And do you have to see the movie again to make sure you've gotten certain quotes right? Or do you have a good memory?
I have a good memory. My handwriting is abominable. So I do have to, I mean, I can usually read about a third of what I've scribbled in the dark. And but as far as, you know, just accuracy goes, you know, we have this wonderful luxury at The New Yorker called the fact-checking department. So if I've blown a quote or mistranscribed something or failed to describe a camera movement in a scene accurately, they'll catch up for me.
That's interesting that even the reviews have that kind of fact checking.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I mean, you know, wherever possible, about 90% of the time, 99% of the time, the fact checkers do see the movies. Either going to a screening themselves or sometimes getting a tape. And, you know, if all else fails, they will call the movie company and verify everything and everything that I've said.
Do you see a lot of movies that you end up not writing about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't, I'm not sure I write about half of the movies that I see. I probably write about maybe a third of the movies I see. I mean, there's so much out there that, particularly here in New York, you're covering, I mean, there are all these independent films and foreign films in addition to the major releases out there. And, you know, there's just a tremendous volume. And, you know, you try to see as much of it as you can. But, you know, from that, I mean, I prefer to, you know, to just take one or two movies per column and concentrate on those rather than just, you know, than just sort of spewing forth an opinion about everything I've seen. I mean, that's just, you know, that's just sort of banal connoisseurship as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, I mean, I'd prefer to, you know, to write about, you know, in whatever period it is, I mean, the one or two movies that interest me most and that I feel I have interesting things to say about.
What's a movie in the past few weeks that you saw and decided not to review?
Boy. Well, Point of No Return, for example, is a picture I saw. Unfortunately, it was only 2 days before the opening, which made it difficult for me to make a deadline, impossible for me to make a deadline, in fact. So I sort of passed that over. And then I passed it over in the next column, too, just because, you know, by the time I had a chance to write about it, you know, it just no longer seemed worth having an opinion about. You know, it's just one of the, you know, the vast majority of movies, which, you know, you sit there, it's not very good. It's not so terrible that you're outraged and you feel like you must warn everybody, you know, not to spend your $7.50 on this. And then you leave the theater, you know, unchanged and unmoved. You know, I mean, if you don't write about these movies immediately, then, you know, the moment is lost because, I mean, trying to evoke a reaction to them that wasn't very strong in the first place, you know, 10 days later is virtually impossible.
Terrence Rafferty, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Terrence Rafferty is film critic for The New Yorker. He has a new collection of his essays and reviews called The Thing Happens. This is Fresh Air. Big day for Clinton administration issues. Hearings on gays in the military and the Task Force on Healthcare Reform met today. Linda Wertheimer, what do you have on that on All Things Considered?
Well, we're watching both events and we'll have stories on both things. Gays in the military is, of course, one of the most controversial issues the Clinton administration faces, and healthcare reform one of the most difficult. We'll also have Mike Schuster reporting from Russia on the fortunes of Boris Yeltsin. We have a piece on a Vietnamese boat person who has returned to Vietnam. He's now a millionaire businessman in Minnesota, and he's gone home to look at business opportunities there. And we'll have a report from Tuzla about refugees who've arrived from Srebrenica and conditions that are described as appalling.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When book critic John Leonard got a copy of The Rape of the Rose by British writer Glyn Hughes, it intrigued him because it was about the Luddites. The Luddites, you may recall from their minor mention in high school history books, were bands of 19th-century English craftsmen who rebelled against technology. Their goal was to destroy the textile machinery that was making their jobs obsolete. How has Hughes made the subject come alive? Splendidly, says John.
It's not as if the English novel kept its mouth shut about what happened to the working classes during the Industrial Revolution of the early 19th century. Dickens and George Eliot, Disraeli and Elizabeth Gaskell, Thomas Hardy, and even later on D.H. Lawrence had their say. But they usually said it from the point of view of the resting classes. And it's amazing how often the difficulties of their characters were resolved by a fortuitous marriage, or a miraculous inheritance, or sudden death, or immigration to Australia. No such luck for Moore, Grieve, and Mary the Scar in Glyn Hughes's remarkable novel about the Luddite Rebellion of 1812. They are poor, and they are doomed. There is at first a fairy tale quality about this novel by a poet. Moore, Grieve is a handloom weaver, a schoolmaster in the village of Ladywell in Yorkshire, and a secret scribbler of notes on nature and politics. He will flee across the moors with a violin on his back and a magic stone in his pocket. He will team up with Mary the Scar in her blue cloak with red-painted cheeks and dyed black hair, a woman of hard times and easy virtue, who taught herself to read from tombstones, the Bible, and pornography, who's heard some Mozart on the harpsichord, but who's also on the run. From a child whose hungry mouth she stopped with dirt. You with your fiddle, says Mary to Moore, and me with my own instrument for playing, we'll get by. But they are not allowed to. They are not allowed to because all of England's soldiers are against them, and mill owners and village spies, and the Industrial Revolution. In 1812, orphans are carted off to workhouses. 5-year-old children are indentured to satanic mills. A man can be hanged for poaching a trout or a rabbit, and a woman for stealing a shilling's worth of shoes. In one direction, from Manchester, delinquents are deported to the penal colonies. In another, troublemakers become cannon fodder for the Napoleonic Wars. In a third, slave ships leave for America. Bad enough that Moore Grieve reads books by Tom Paine. He is also the scribe for a local band of Luddites. These machine smashers have come down to us in history as mindless vandals. They emerge instead from the pages of The Rape of the Rose as radicals in the tradition of the French and American revolutions. Their rage wasn't so much at power looms or threshing machines as at the destruction of their communities by a new system of social domination. It's not an accident that England began hanging poachers at exactly the same time as its aristocratic classes took up hunting and shooting as leisure activities. No wonder artisans smashed machines in 1812, as in the 1830s the landless unemployed would burn hayricks and demand either bread or blood and bargain collectively by riot. Nowhere in the 19th century novel did we get anything as raw as what we read here on life in the mill and the poorhouse, the brothel and the lunatic asylum. Nothing that smells so powerfully of machine oil, gunpowder, turnips, and debauchery. I won't tell you why Mary the Scar calls Moore Grieve Moore Grief, nor explain the various meanings of rose, which range from William Blake to the War of the Roses. I will say that The Rape of the Rose is the best historical novel I've read since Thomas Flanagan's The Year of the French, which was also about exalted poetry and doomed revolution.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Rape of the Rose by Glenn Hughes. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Ojiva Blytus and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Senate Armed Services Committee is holding hearings on gays in the military. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Alan Berube, author of Coming Out Under Fire, A History of Gays and Lesbians in World War II. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.